and ohm, and between those two ohms, I had an ohmmeter with the alligator clip leads connected to the two aluminum bowls. Remember now when I connected the two alligator clips to my left hand finger and thumb and index finger and thumb and my right hand index finger and thumb, I measured 500,000 ohms. When I did it between my left arm and my right arm, where my arm only from elbow to wrist was under phony seawater, left arm and right arm, I measured 1,000 ohms. If I did the next experiment, if I did this with my whole left hand leg and my whole left hand right hand leg under seawater, and I measured the number of ohms, I think I would measure 100 ohms. As you increase the amount of skin area that's opposed to seawater, exposed to seawater, which means the total number of parallel paths between all of those capillaries at the skin of my body going into my arteries and veins. As I increase the area, the apparent impedance between those two portions of my body goes down real fast. It is my guess that when I'm standing in seawater up to my knees or maybe up to my waist, between my left hand leg, the impedance of my right hand leg into that seawater, I think I've got roughly 10 ohms of impedance. Can that electrocute me? Easily. So you got to be careful now how you measure human being impedance. What is the conductivity? Let me drop. What is the conductivity of the fluid that your body is in, and what amount of area in square feet, square inches, square meters of your body is exposed to the material? Makes a huge difference. You thought that the temperature of the seawater is a factor. I say it is not. Ordinary seawater at room temperature is 0.2 ohms per meter of resistivity, 0.2 ohms, which happens to be the same number for human blood, by the way. And whether that seawater is hot or cold, which means it goes from 0.15 to 2 to 0.25, doesn't matter. That seawater is so extremely conductive compared to you, you can consider it a zero-ohm impedance surface. And the only thing that's going to protect you is the resistivity of the amount of area of your body that's exposed to the seawater, and how far is your left-hand leg as one probe of one of the sliders of the potentiometer, and your right-hand leg, which is the other slider of the potentiometer, and what's the voltage difference between the two. I think from left-hand leg to right-hand leg in seawater, it is my guess I can be electrocuted with 10 volts. Is that potentiometer of the seawater with 110 volts or 220 volts, is that potentiometer going to have 10 volts across it? In which case, if my left leg and right, my right leg is in that potentiometer, there's a good probability I'm going to die from electrocution. So don't go into seawater. No matter how valuable that material is in your basement, if that electricity is turned on, don't go there. Of those 60 people who died from looks like drowning, it is my guess a high percentage of them, based on my experiments, are telling me they died of electrocution. Unfortunately, when you do a autopsy of a person who just died, and you try to differentiate electrocution from drowning, in either case, you've got water in the lungs. In either case, I'm not sure you can tell. First of all of those 60 people did not get an autopsy, but if they did, would they really be able to tell the difference? Particularly where you've got the situation of where one brother tried to recover the other brother. One brother was in the basement, he knew he didn't come back up, the other brother went down there to try to recover him, and both of them ended up drowning in that basement, and the water did not come up to the ceiling of the basement, and these guys are good swimmers. To me, that's fairly strong evidence of electrocution. We got to go over to hear what's going on in space. So, Paul, a
few cents. See, the thing is that I was electrocuted thousands of times. When I was young, I wasn't really afraid of it. Electricity. It depends how where is the part. If you have a part that doesn't go to your heart, you have more chances to survive than if you go with the head to hands on the electric circuit. But when you're talking about the impedance of resistance, the resistance of the human body is between 300 to 1,000 ohms. But we're not dealing really with the resistance, we're dealing with the impedance. And also it's worth to mention that the electrical impedance of the body is only part of the equation. That means that the current flows through the cross section of the thickness of the conductor. So if you go trying to realize what is the danger, you rather trying to see salt water versus the conductivity of that water at say given temperature, because that's important. So at 20 degrees and the salinity of 35 kilograms per 35 grams per kilogram, you would end up somewhere between 4.7 4.8 of Siemens per meter, and that of course will give you a solid proof that it is true that what I said. When you're going to the basin, the reservoir with the water, the wider the reservoir it is, at the given current, or the given voltage potential, the given current flow, the more chances you are having to survive. In the very much extreme, we could say that you go to the salt water in the ocean, you have the same current that you have in your basement, you would probably never feel that. Depends how far away are the electrons. So it is a kind of controversial subject. It is not really what you're saying is that, you know what, you get there, yeah, you're going to get electrical circuited. Well, possibly yes, more or less, and to XGN.
Back in 10, 20 years ago, when we used to have electric drill motors with a metal outer case, it was extremely tempting to take your rowboat, tip it upside down near shore, pull it up on shore, tip it upside down, and you take a electric motor with a sanding disc on the end of it, and you're going to sand off those monocles on the bottom of your boat. There's a ridiculous number of people who died of electrocution with their feet in seawater and their hand on the metal case of that electric drill motor, starting to sand off the monocles on the bottom of their rowboat. Extremely dangerous procedure, where the current now flows between your feet and your hand with that thing in your hand. If there's any electrical error in that electric drill motor, back in the days when they were not double insulated with a plastic case. The bottom line of all this is anything to do with electricity and seawater, don't go there. If you are in that seawater and a couple of hundred yards away, a lightning bolt strikes that seawater, there's a high probability you're going to be electrocuted. It's a huge potentiometer with a lot of voltage drop across it. You're an impedance in that seawater that's relatively low. Enough current's going to flow through you. You're going to be electrocuted. That's for you.
The question is very simple. You're going to the salt water when you have a 220 volts at 1 amp, and then you're wearing on yourself a suit that is made out of copper. Are you going to get electrocuted or not going to feel anything at all? There's a very simple Tesla made for the people that was repeated many times by the scientists. Are you not? And to XGN.
If I'm inside of a metal cage, as Tesla did too, and all the current flows on the outside of the cage, yes, you're safe. And are you going to tell me the seawater is like that cage? No way in hell.
Take into consideration the impedance at a given point to the current that is flowing through the salt water in your body. And to XGN.
That cage, that metal cage that Tesla used, was a highly conductive thing. The seawater is a potentiometer. The cage is not a potentiometer. If he poured enough current across that cage from top to bottom, and his feet are touching the bottom of the cage, and his arms and hands are touching the top of the cage, he would be electrocuted. Seawater can do that. We've got to move on. Paul, WS2N, tell us what happened with that attempted tail landing on the barge. WS2N, K2LIW, go ahead with the space report.
This is WS2N. Yes, Falcon 9 successfully took off. I mean, it's a successful mission as far as NASA is concerned. The idea is to bring another 5,000 pounds up to the International Space Station, and which they did. I mean, it'll be there tomorrow morning at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. The launch was successful. They went to MECO after a couple of minutes. That's the main engine cut off, and then the first stage separates. Second stage comes on, and that fired for about 7 or 8 minutes, and then they go to CECO, second engine cut off, and the rest of it goes up to the International Space Station. But the first stage, we talked about on and at many times, the plan for SpaceX is to bring the first stage, the booster, back eventually to a launch pad. Over the last year and a half, they've successfully brought the booster back to the water, vertically, drop it. And this time they had a plan on landing on a barge. Now they call it an autonomous spaceport barge. So they pushed this thing out to the Atlantic Ocean, a couple hundred miles off the coast of Jacksonville, Florida. The rocket took off, going for a 51-degree inclination, so the rocket was going north, northeast. And if I was up at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, whenever it was, I think it was a little after 4 o'clock in the morning, this thing took off, you'd probably be able to see this thing go out, even from New York. But I wasn't. I didn't see it live. But 10 minutes after the launch, booster was came back and actually crash landed onto the barge. So I haven't seen any damage or pictures yet. You know, they haven't shown how close to the center of the target they hit. The idea is to fire 3 of the 9 rockets that are in the first stage to boost it, to slow it down. Now this thing's up 60 miles, going at roughly almost 3,000 miles an hour. And then as it comes down closer to where they gotta go, they fire the engines again, slow it down even more. And then right at the very end, they're supposed to fire the engines for a third time, one engine at the end. And that would land it onto the spaceport. Before they land onto the spaceport, large legs, 30-foot legs, 4 of them come down hydraulically. And it will eventually land on the platform. Before that even happens, when they're high in the atmosphere, they have these fins that open up, these large fins, and they're also hydraulically operated. That's near the top of the booster. So as this thing is coming down vertically, the top of the booster, of course, is higher than the lower part. And these fins help direct it toward its location where it wants to land. And because it was a little low on hydraulics, they only put a certain amount in. The hydraulic fluid ran out. The steering, they kind of lost the steering capability. This is according to Elon Musk, what he put on his Twitter report. In the last couple of seconds, they didn't have enough hydraulic fluid left to control the fins to actuate them properly. So next flight, he's added 50% more fluid, more hydraulic fluid. So he figures that won't happen next time. So that's what happened to that guy. Before I go on, you probably want to ask about this pretty good achievement to come from 60 miles up and hit a little spot in the middle of the ocean. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I would consider this a partial success, Paul.
He came very close. I hear tell that the visibility was such that they didn't get good photography of the landing, and they knew it landed hard on the barge. So, and I guess it got damaged. Here's my question, Paul. If I was bringing back a booster, and I know that I've got to go through the atmosphere to come back down, let me pick a number, 50,000 feet or so, I'd like to do some of that descent with a parachute, because the air is free and it can do a lot of slowdown of your booster. And now jettison the parachute and the last 1,000 feet come down with rocket power, as opposed to using rocket power all the way. I think I would come out ahead. I'll admit that I've got to worry about the volume and the mass of the parachute assembly that's on that booster. But from what you're describing, I think he did all of the deceleration and descent and try to come to a nice, slow, controlled landing on the barge, all with rocket power, and where the hydraulic fluid, let me drop, where he ran out of hydraulic fluid, I'm having trouble understanding what happened. Was there a leak in the hydraulic system? How did he run out of hydraulic fluid? If it's a closed cycle hydraulic system that's moving actuators, that's moving aiming devices on the rocket motors, why should that run out of hydraulic fluid? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I have a question, Dick.
Okay, I'll pull first and then John in that order. You got a pull.
Yeah, that was one of the questions, and he had answered it that it is not a closed loop system. So to have that, it would increase the mass of the whole setup. We'd have to add too much fluid to it. Something along those lines. I haven't seen a diagram of how this works. I do know how hydraulics work, but how that setup is working, I don't know. It's what he considers an open system. So that answers that question best I can answer it without seeing diagrams of how they do this. Now, you know, hydraulics are involved in a couple of things. The fins near the top, and also the landing legs that open up. So there's hydraulics involved with that as well. And I know John wanted to say something. John?
Yeah, Dick, I was questioning the parachute, because if it's coming down basically as a projectile and slight guidance, if you put a parachute on that, I think the wind currents would probably take it way off course. I don't think they'd have enough to navigate. Maybe wrong, but maybe Paul has info on that. Back to you, Dick.
You've got a call.
Yeah, of course, he's got this plan to do without parachutes ever. And NASA did that for a couple of decades with the solid booster rockets, successfully landing the solid booster rockets in the ocean and reusing, some or all of the solid booster components. And, you know, they reflied a lot of parts. In fact, one part that flew on the last shuttle was actually used on the first shuttle. There was still one part that they were reusing from the solid booster setup. So, Ariane 5 has had parachutes as well for their solid booster rockets. They never planned on reusing them. They would land them in the water and evaluate them just for evaluation purposes. But this is, of course, the first time that somebody's going to try to do this without parachutes. And to get the pinpoint accuracy that he needs, I mean, his goal is not only to land on this spaceport, floating spaceport, but he wants to land on right where he started from, right out of Florida, or right out of Vandenberg Air Force Base, which he leases a launch complex over there. With a couple hundred million dollar launch complex. He's building the first commercial launch complex ever built anywhere down near Brownsville, Texas. Dick, over here.
Yeah, I've got a bunch of guesses here, Paul. Maybe you can See if my guesses are even close. In the case of the booster, it's boosting the rest of the vehicle to as high a possible altitude in the right direction, the right inclination of orbit, and where the booster cuts off its boosting function is well known. That's a point in the sky. You know where that is. And if you now disconnect that booster from the rest of the vehicle and you deploy a parachute, and yes, the wind is going to blow you in some direction. However, to some degree, you know which way the wind is blowing that day. Therefore, you can position the barge in the right place so it's convenient. And then you allow the parachute to do a lot of the descent. I'm going to make a guess now that the first stage of boosting ends at, watch, let's pick a number, 30-mile altitude. So 30 miles up, the booster finishes its function.
It's 60 when it separates.
60 miles, okay. So at 60 miles, it separates. You're 60 miles in the air, which means you're above 98% of the atmosphere. You deploy a parachute at that time and come back down, and most of that descent is at a controlled rate by way of the parachute. And if you know ahead of time which way the wind is blowing, in theory, you know approximately where to position your barge. And now, you don't want the parachute in the way of the landing procedure, so let me pick a number, 1,000 feet above the ground, you jettison the parachute, and now by pure rocket power, you do a descent, a controlled descent, and hopefully back down very, in a nice controlled manner down to your barge. And I can also see that, let me drop, a closed-loop hydraulic system needs a continuous source of power, which is usually done with an APU, an auxiliary power unit. So that's another significant piece of hardware to supply the power, the hydraulic power, to run a closed-loop hydraulic system. By comparison, if I've got a tank of hydraulic fluid that is pressurized, and now I pour that pressurized hydraulic fluid into my actuators, and the output of the actuator just dumps it into the air, I now have a much simpler system, and maybe that's how he did it. So maybe he didn't make it a closed hydraulic system because he didn't want to install the auxiliary power unit. A bunch of guesses, as you can tell. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, okay, you're basing that on, for instance, the APUs that they had on Shell. They had three of them. If they failed, they would abort the launch. That controlled everything. Without that, they wouldn't even have guidance. They wouldn't have the wings wouldn't the flaps wouldn't work. Nothing would work on return from flight. And yeah, that would be a closed system. But this, yeah, he said this is not a closed system. The mass would be too much. And as far as parachutes, I don't know, 60 miles up, I guess the air is pretty rarefied. For the parachutes to start opening, it'd have to come down lower. But he's got enough fuel. I mean, he's done, it's not like he hasn't done this before. He's done it twice, and he'll bring it right. You've seen pictures where it's right above the water. It touches the water, and then it just falls over. Destroyed. So, but his accuracy is really improved with these fins. The very first flight that he tried, he depended on nitrogen jets firing to control the attitude of the rocket on the way down. And he said you would need, there's no way after the first test that you could depend on the nitrogen jets. But to control it, he came up with these fins, and you can see how they work. They not only open and close, but they actuate. They turn on an angle. So he's really flying this thing back down to the booster, back down to the barge. Yeah, you were saying originally 50,000 feet up on this is like 60 miles up. So you think about something going 3,000 miles an hour, and it's like a 14-story building going that fast, to get this thing to slow down with three rocket firings, one to boost it back to where he wants to go. I remember listening to the replay, and Miko was around, I think they said it was 60 kilometers out, so it wasn't all that far out, and, you know, from Florida. So, you know, when I first heard 200 miles off Jacksonville, I was wondering if that sounded like the right place, but it turned out to be perfect. And to get this thing to come down and actually hit the barge, I mean, that's phenomenal. He gave himself a 50-50 chance because he's got another 11 or 12 flights this year to do it. And maybe next time he might do it with more hydraulic fluid. Back to you there.
Yeah, run that by again, Paul. He delivered, last year, week, he told me around 4,000 pounds. This week he said it's around 5,000 pounds. And he's got 11 or 12 more flights. Are all of these cargo missions for the International Space Station? Let me round off the number to 10. Let's assume he's going to have a total of 10 launches to the International Space Station at 5,000 pounds of cargo each. That's 50,000 pounds of cargo to the International Space Station to support those experiments, give them some spare hardware, and supply the consumables for the six astronauts. That's a lot of stuff. So are most of those next 11 to 12 missions, are those cargo missions to the International Space Station, WS2N, K2LIW, in the second end?
Yeah, well, this is CRS-5, and the rest of this year he's got, let's see, 6, 7, and 8. So I think he's got 3 or 4 flights to the space station, probably another 3, maybe 3 or 4 to the space station. So, you know, he's got a $1.8 billion contract with NASA to deliver 12 cargo flights to the space station before, probably because, we're up to 2017. 2018, the new bid goes out. So between now and 2017, he's got to get another 7 flights up to complete his contract. Orbital Science had eight flights on their manifest. Now, that's not to say you're gonna have a lot of flights up during this year. You have maybe 3 or 4 SpaceX. You've got a Japanese one going up not too long from now. You've got three progress ships between now and August, I was reading. So, I mean, the list is endless. You don't have any more ATVs going up, automatic transit vehicles, by the European Space Agency. They've now stopped that. Each one of those was three times the amount that progress craft could bring up. So, let's see, I'm getting away from myself here, but a lot of flights go into the space station. Okay, other flights is the question. Yeah, for instance, his next flight is at the end of January on the 29th. He's got the Discover mission, we dropped it, for NOAA, and he's got other missions lined up for the military. And for instance, this flight is going up from Florida at the end of the month, and it's going to the L1 position. They're going to put NOAA wants a spacecraft located in that L1 position, 1 million miles out, 4 times the distance of the moon. Not quite 1 million, but out there, 950,000 miles, close enough for government work, roughly four times the distance of the moon, sitting in L1 position with four big instruments on board the spacecraft. Two will be measuring the solar properties. It's kind of like pick up where the ACE spacecraft is sitting out there for the last, I guess, 13 years. That's kind of like wearing out. So it'll pick up the slack from that when that fails. But it'll also be looking back with the cameras at Earth 24 hours a day, because the Earth will be illuminated 24 hours from that location between the it'll be located between the Sun and the Earth. The Discover mission is on track to be launched by SpaceX at the end of the month. And by the way, that flight was the old Triana flight. So listen to me, I guess 13 years ago, 12, 13 years ago, I used to talk about Triana. They planned on putting that mission at location, you know, in 2000 and probably 2 or 3, and it never happened. Some people nicknamed it the Al Gore mission because it was going to stare at the Earth and kind of confirm that global climate problems with the, this constant problem that they're always arguing about, that's been confirmed now, and it's really, the Republicans got in, they didn't want this Triana to go up. But they told NASA, put that spacecraft away. So they put it in a cubbyhole somewhere, some clean room garage, and they left it there for a decade. And now they dragged it out again. And repurposed it, renamed it Discover, and gave it to a private company to put out at the L1 position. Now, I'm still trying to figure out if this next flight is going to have landing legs on it, and if they're going to try to do the same thing. The last couple of flights that SpaceX has put, for instance, into geosynchronous orbit, they did not have landing legs. They needed all the fuel that they could get to put that spacecraft at that location. Now, this is a smaller spacecraft. It's only a couple thousand pounds. But they're going to put it at the L1 position. You know, how much fuel is that going to use? I don't know. I still can't find anywhere on the internet yet if this flight is going to be an attempt to land again on the barge. But we'll see. Let you know in a couple of weeks. Back to you, Dick, WS2M.
Good information, Paul. Now, you said it, and I'm not quite clear. At the major engine cutoff, MECO, of this booster that he's trying to bring back to the barge, I think you told me it occurs at 60 kilometers altitude, roughly 220 kilometers downrange. Is that approximately the position in the sky in which this thing finishes its MECO? In which case, from there, it's, in theory, coming back down by gravity. And yes, the air is pretty thin up there, so the parachute at first doesn't do you much if you use the parachute. And if you use controllable fins with the air supply, air going through them, that allows you to do a lot of steering without much energy. Okay? You take, for instance, the totally flying surfaces, which are the vertical stabilizer of the SR-71 or the horizontal stabilizer of an F-15 aircraft, where the thing that you call stabilizer, the whole horizontal stabilizer, pivots from a point midway between the leading edge and the trailing edge. So therefore, very little force required to do the pivoting creates a change in deflection, which gives you a force of the air against it, and tremendous amount of pounds of force are created by steering that control surface, and it takes very little force to do it. So imagine these control vanes on a Falcon 9 booster are somewhat like that. I mean, if you try to get that amount of force by way of reaction control jets, it requires a lot of stuff, where it's just moving a vane that pivots from the center. Takes very little energy, and you get a lot of force out of it, as long as you've got airspeed. but I'm not sure you can land with that. Although maybe those controllable vanes are in the exhaust. Let me drop. Maybe they're in the exhaust of the rocket, and they can tolerate the temperature. And now you're essentially steering that rocket. That would be an easier method rather than try to gimbal the whole rocket. So, as you can tell, I want to know, are they gimbaling the rocket? Are they just steering vanes that are in the exhaust nozzle of the rocket? And was the end of MECO at 60 kilometers altitude and 220 kilometers downrange, is that where MECO first occurred? And then you came essentially straight down to the barge from that point? WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, 60 miles up is what I read. And then listening to their playback, they were out probably 100 kilometers when I heard MECO, so probably beyond that before, you know, there's a lot of coasting involved. So after main engine cutoff, they do have nitrogen jets to try to reorient it. Essentially, you're really in space 60 miles up. Try to orient the booster properly, and then when it's in the right location, it fires the three Merlin engines. They have nine of them, but eventually, when they get to the point where the air is thick enough, not so rarefied, then these fins that pop out are able to catch some air and start controlling its descent. And not only keeping the top rod vertical, but also, directing it to where they need to land it. And these fins that pop out, you can actually see what they look like. They made them a little bit bigger for the actual flight. But if you Google SpaceX Falcon 9R, that's their reusable rocket. Well, they're both building another one. Last 6 months or so ago, theirs blew up on one of the tests, but down in McGregor, Texas, where they test these things. But that's where they were testing the
repeater. Timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
R stands for reusability. Let me drop it. And took off from the launch pad with the legs open, in the open position. It took off, went up, 3,000-4,000 feet, whatever it is, and then came back down and landed right back on the launch pad. But what they were using were these fins controlling it. You can see them. They're about 12 foot off the top of the 140-foot booster, roughly a 14-story building, and about 10 feet, looks about like about 10 feet down from the top, and they open up, and they could open up all the way, or halfway, or they could actuate, they could turn, to let some air just, not grab the full amount of air. With the combination of these four things, there's four of them, they're able to maneuver the booster back to where they need to bring it. They're not down by the engine exhaust or anything. They're not doing anything down there. Back to you, Dick.
So they're only using the air flowing past them because of velocity to do controlling. But what's going to be doing the servo mechanism controlling of altitude and attitude as you back down to that barge? If these fins are only in the airstream and not in the exhaust of the nozzle, then what is doing the steering, so to speak, when you're backing down to the barge? Back to you, Paul.
Well, the final is the center rocket. That's the only one that's firing at the end, and that one has controls on it. They have two actuators, one, set it like 90 degrees to one another, so they control the center rocket. I know the outer eight, I don't think I don't think they move. And then the 10th one, of course, is actually the Merlin engine that they use for the second stage. That is controlled by the same type of thing, two actuators. Actually, it's made by a company called Jensen, but it's no relation to me. They spell their last name with an E, not an O. But they were responsible for these actuators, and they're about, I guess, 18 inches long and maybe a foot wide, and they're mounted to control the exhaust shed, for instance, on the second stage show. And that was a problem on the 6th. This thing was supposed to take off on the 6th, but it went down to 1.5 minutes, and one of the controllers called a halt, and they aborted and scrubbed for the day and made the flight on the 10th of January because they were having trouble. There was a little too much play or something in one of these actuators. So SpaceX changed it out, and it took off successfully on Saturday back to Egypt.
So if I understand correctly, during the back down, the center engine is gimbaled. In other words, it can be steered in attitude, latitude and longitude, so to speak, or right ascension and tech. It can be steered in two axes at right angles. So the center engine is gimbaled, so that allows you to do both orientation and thrust control, and the center engine has enough thrust to at least equal the mass of that booster. I think you said the booster is 120 feet tall. Whoa. What does that thing weigh? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
I know when it's filled up, it weighs a lot, but I guess when it's empty, it's 5% of the total weight. You know, most of it's all fuel. Now, we're making some assumptions here. I know they control the going uphill. The engines are controllable. So I'm making an assumption that they're controlling it on the way back. But that kind of information, when you get that detailed, is very hard to get. For instance, I can't even get a confirmation of the next test that they're going to try this and land it on their barge. But I'm going to hope that it's the end of January. Otherwise, we'll have to wait another month. But roughly one flight a month is their plans for the SpaceX. You could look at it that way. Now, you're talking about all the cargo flights that they're making up to the space station. Boeing is now going to put a bid in. The first bids are going to be over like in 2017, 2016. And then they're going to need more cargo flights up to the space station. And I'm sure SpaceX will become part of that. They'll probably give them, another $1 billion or whatever it is. Then Orbital Science, of course, was involved. They're still going to launch an Antares rocket. That's the one that blew up. They're planning on launching Antares. But before they do, they're going to also use an Atlas V to fill in the gap for the next year. It's going to take them a year to get ready. But another company on board is going to be involved, Boeing. Looks like they're going to get involved with the cargo. Originally, they were just planning on building a spacecraft, which they're in the process of doing, for sending astronauts to and from the space station. But I think they're going to get on board with the cargo as well. They're going to take the same spacecraft that they're building for crewed flight, and they're going to modify it for a cargo flight, and they're going to get involved with probably another 4,000 to 5,000 pound payload up to the space station, and they'll probably put a bid, probably win that from NASA to do the same thing that SpaceX and Orbital are doing now. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to ask you a series of questions about the first stage booster of Falcon 9, SpaceX Falcon 9. Nine, I think, is telling me that there are nine engines on board. I believe the center engine is the one that is gimbaled, that can be doing steering. The other eight engines maybe do not do steering. Maybe they just give you pure thrust. But now the next question is, those other eight engines, are they also liquid fueled engines, which in theory can be controlled in thrust, and differentially controlled in thrust to do steering? Or maybe they're solid rocket boosters. So are the nine engines, are all of them liquid powered engines, or some of them are boosters? And is all the steering done by the center gimbaled engine? Or if they're all liquid engines, you can differentially control the thrust of the engines at 9 o'clock versus 6 o'clock, if you know what I mean. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, I can tell you what I know and what I don't know. First of all, what I don't know, I make an assumption that only one of the engines are gimbaled, because I read that one time. Reading something one time doesn't confirm things. I need to read it two or three times in different locations. So I believe that's the way it is. I don't believe the outer ones are. Yes, there's nine engines in the first booster. It's 140 feet high, so it's equivalent to, they always say, 10 feet per story, so equivalent to a 14-story building. They all run on RP one, which is, you know, a rocket propellant is, when they write it up as RP, that's kerosene. So it's a kerosene liquid oxygen rocket. And they call it the Falcon 9. They first started, Falcon 9's first four or five flights were arranged differently than they are now. They would, if you look at the bottom, there were nine engines, and they were straight in line, you know, three, three, and three. And then about four missions ago, they, first one that flew in the new configuration was out in Vandenberg, California, and they wanted to, they rearranged it, made it easy to install and to work on. They put one engine in the middle, and then in a big circle, octagon, set up around that middle, they arranged the other engines. They also made the whole first booster longer, so they had 30% more fuel to drive it. Then that's why in the beginning they were taking up like 3,000 pounds to the space station. Now they can bring up 5,000 pounds because they have a bigger booster. The diameter didn't change, but the length did. As far as these engines, they call them the Falcon 9. That Falcon is a rocket. But the engines are called Merlin. Each one is called a Merlin engine. So there's really 10 Merlin engines on board. For simplicity, he makes all the same engines, all the same fuel. So the booster has nine. The second stage has another Merlin engine. Well, it has a different shaped cone. It's operated a little differently. It's vacuum rated, so it can operate in outer space. So that's their 10th engine. So for every flight they fly, they fly 10 engines. That's one of the reasons he'd like to bring this thing back to a launch pad. He could reuse these engines. They're reusable up to, theoretically, 40, 50 times. He could use these things over and over again. That's the way he's been building them. Back to you, Dick.
Great stuff. Gotta think big. Big number of pounds, big vehicles, high velocities, high altitudes. Paul, I think you keep track of all of the space reports you've given us. Lots of good information. By now, I'm guessing you're up to space report number 140. Am I even close? WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, I don't know. We've been doing it for many years. But those numbers there, I know when you were here, you saw the numbers. That's when I first started doing it on the computer, you know, tablet now, and he bought it with a big computer and everything onto the tablet. So that's where we're at. Want to say something else about the flight, SpaceX. Yeah, it went out of my head, but it's a good company. They're going to have competition, and that's the way it should be. And we expect to see manned flights by 2017 from U.S. soil. Back to you, Dick.
About 2 minutes, Dick.
I think we have even less than that. You guys have just heard TechNet number 1538 of the series that began in September of 1982, 32 years ago. Be kind to each other. See you next week. And we're going to settle some of these issues by then. KC2WGB, K2IW. Put tie the ribbons on it, John.
No, I always get my fingers stuck in the ribbon. KC2WGB. Well, I want to thank everybody for joining, and everybody have a great week. And good night, Dick, Paul, everyone listening, and hope to have you all here again next week. KC2WGB.
And I was thinking some very kind words about you today, John. I finally got around to installing a 10 microfarad 280 volt capacitor, and boy, does it improve the performance. I'm going to go over to the other machine. Did that improve the performance? So you sent that to me in May, and I finally got around to installing it. Thank you. Bye bye for now. K2LIW. Okay. Maybe I should give you a phone call. Bye bye for now. And I might even give you a call tonight. Although I've got to do something for the next 10 minutes. So I might give you a call tonight. You available? Bye bye, you all.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.